Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. 1 year later, the country reflects on the murder of George Floyd as the city of Minneapolis struggles to reform its police department. Then, Taiwan on edge. We speak with the country's foreign minister about the ever larger shadow China casts over the region. And Brazil in crisis. COVID-19 exacerbates the many inequities across the country, hitting minority and indigenous communities the hardest.
As with any pandemic, what we see are all inequalities are illuminated. The most vulnerable, the people that were more isolated, ethnic minorities, they are the ones that really are suffering the most.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. Around the country today, Americans have marked the anniversary of George Floyd's death. It came at the hands of a Minneapolis police officer 1 year ago today. Yamiche Alcindor begins our coverage.
1 year after the murder of George Floyd, community members gathered to pay their respects and renew demands for racial justice and police reform. They also held an outdoor festival at the intersection where he died 1 year ago today. Using music and food, the crowd tried to turn a place of agony into a place of hope.
It's been a troubling year, a long year, but we made it.
On May 25th, 2020, George Floyd was killed by former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, who kneeled on Floyd's neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds.
We, the jury, in the above entitled matter, find the defendant guilty.
In April, Chauvin was convicted of second-degree murder and other charges. He awaits sentencing next month.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
The murder triggered nationwide protests and calls for police reform that have continued throughout the year, including yesterday at a march to the Minnesota State Capitol. George Floyd's family has taken a lead role in those efforts.
Good morning, everyone.
Today, the family was in Washington. They met first with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and other congressional leaders amid a push for a federal bill dubbed the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act. The legislation would ban chokeholds, among other provisions. Floyd's brother, Felonious, urged the Senate to pass the House-approved bill.
We need to be able to set standard procedures in place, just like we need meaningful legislation. When they signed that George Floyd Policing Act, we need it on Biden's desk. The Senate, we need to get this taken care of.
The family spoke separately with Democratic Senator Cory Booker and Republican Senator Tim Scott, who are leading negotiations for a compromise to get the bill passed. At the White House, President Biden and Vice President Harris hosted the family privately. They spoke to reporters afterward.
He did let us know that he supports passing the bill, but he wants to make sure that it's the right bill and not a rush bill.
At today's White House briefing, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Biden was hopeful a consensus could be reached.
We have been respecting the space needed for the negotiators to have these discussions about where they can find common ground and where they can find agreement.
The federal efforts come as many cities and states have moved to change policing policies after Floyd's death. Last July, Minnesota became one of the first states to ban police chokeholds and mandate mental health training for police officers, among other things. And today, the Floyd family announced the launch of a fund to benefit businesses and community organizations in the neighborhood where George Floyd died. They'll be using money from the family's $27 million settlement with Minneapolis. In August, three officers who were on the scene with Chauvin are set to stand trial for their involvement.
Excuse us.
Before today's event at George Floyd Square, an Associated Press journalist captured the sounds of what he said were 30 gunshots a block away from the intersection. A reminder of the challenges facing the neighborhood.
And Yamiche joins me now. So Yamiche, as you reported, George Floyd's family met with President Biden today. What more do we know about that meeting?
Well, this was an hour-long private meeting between President Biden, who has known tragic
public loss in the Floyd family that, of course, also knows tragic public loss, of course, at the hands of police. Now, President Biden, I'm told, was very personal with this family. He's gotten to know this family over the last year. He's had multiple conversations with them before the verdict, after the verdict. He's talked a lot about the family's well-being, asking them, how are they doing? How are they coping? Do they have the resources they need? The president also released a statement, and I want to read part of it to you. He said, for any family experiencing a profound loss, the first year can feel like they got the news a few seconds ago. And they've had to relive that pain and grief at each and every time those horrific 9 minutes and 29 seconds have been replayed. That statement, of course, talking about the 9 minutes and 29 seconds that Derek Chauvin kneeled on the neck of George Floyd. I'm told by the Floyd family, as well as in public statements, that the president spent some time really talking to them about processing their grief. He also spent some time playing with Gianna Floyd. That's George Floyd's daughter. She ran into the president's arms, he said, and also said, I'm hungry. Do you have some snacks? He gave her some ice cream and Cheetos. So you see there a sort of really genuine back and forth there. But the president also assured this family that he is going to be pushing for policing reform.
And speaking of that, Yamiche, the president had called for Congress to pass the George Floyd Policing Reform Act by now, by this anniversary, but so far no bipartisan agreement. What do we know about where that stands?
Well, President Biden spoke to the Floyd family about this, and he said he was not happy with the idea that the deadline that he set, which is today, the year anniversary of George Floyd's murder, that there wasn't a policing legislation that he could sign into law today. That said, he told the family that he doesn't want to rush this, that he really wants it to be a bill with substance. That said, the Biden administration's overall racial justice agenda is going forward. Just today, Kristen Clark was confirmed by the Senate. She's going to be the first Black woman to head the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice. That, of course, is the division that works specifically with police departments on policy and practices. She's expected to be sworn in tonight by Vice President Harris. So even though the legislation is somewhat stalled and there's still a gulf to go there, there is, of course, Kristen Clark now there at the DOJ.
And finally, Yamiche, the death of George Floyd, of course, triggered these conversations about policing, but also about race and racism in America. And you've done a lot of reporting about this over the last year. You've traveled, you've talked to people. What is your sense of where we are 1 year later?
Well, 1 year later, after the death of George Floyd, we have really experienced a profound shift in perspectives and also profound disappointment in lived realities of so many people of color in this country. So there is this real breath that's been breathed into the Black Lives Matter movement, with corporations and companies really looking at systemic racism, having that racial reckoning that we always talk about, really talking about diversity and the need for change. But there also has been this real pushback through pushing back on the idea of even talking about slavery and the 1619 history there. There also, of course, is this idea that Black Americans are still 2.5 to 3 times more likely to be killed by police than white Americans. And each day, there are still African Americans waking up terrified of the police, having to teach their children how to survive police interactions, even if they're unarmed, even if they're doing nothing wrong. So a lot of change, but so much more to go.
And we know those conversations are going to continue. Yamiche Alcindor reporting today on this day that all of us are marking. Yamiche, thank you.
Thanks.
And members of George Floyd's family also met today with Congresswoman Karen Bass of California. She is the House Democrats' lead negotiator on police reform legislation that was, as we said, named after George Floyd. I spoke with her a short time ago. Representative Karen Bass, thank you so much for joining us. Let me first ask you about your conversation with the George Floyd family. Tell us about it.
Oh, yeah, I mean, this is a very difficult day for the family. Anytime there's an anniversary, a birthday, you know, or today commemorating it was 1 year ago, it's a painful day for them. And so our conversation was just them encouraging Congress to finish the job. And also expressing that they thought it was more important that the job be done correctly rather than rushing to have a bill just to meet a deadline. So I was happy to hear that. I was happy to hear to know that they were not disappointed, but that they were encouraged because our talks have been moving forward.
You say they've been moving forward. What did you tell them about the status of the talks?
Well, I told them that Senator Booker and Senator Scott and I were talking regularly, that we were examining the comprehensive bill that was passed in the House. And, you know, it's almost never that a bill passes the House, goes to the Senate, and nothing changes. So we were also talking about different parts of the bill that they feel are very important. For example, the part of the bill that essentially holds officers accountable. What happened to their brother that the entire world witnessed, they never want to see another family go through.
You're referring to something that's called qualified immunity, legal protection for officers. You've said that this has to be in the bill. Republicans have said they don't want it in the bill. Where do you see this headed?
Well, it's one of many items that are on the table for us to negotiate, and I'm hoping that we will find a resolution. You know, what the bill is about and what this moment in our history is about is really looking at the profession of policing and modernizing it. You know, the profession that has the ability to take away your freedom and take away your life really should meet the highest of standards, should be transparent, should hold each other accountable. If an officer sees another officer brutalizing someone, then they have a legal obligation to intervene. That's one of the provisions in the bill. We have 18,000 police departments across the country and 18,000 different ways of doing policing. Mm. Any profession that reaches that point needs to have national standards, national accreditation. And so that's what we have been talking about.
Is there, though, Congresswoman Bass, a middle ground when it comes to this sort of legal protection? Could it be protection for the department, which we know has been raised by some?
Well, that is one of the options that we're examining. But there's also the issue of holding officers accountable and being able to prosecute an officer. You know, one of the things that is so painful for families and communities when they see incident after incident, tape after tape, and then the officers aren't even prosecuted. They don't even file charges. And that's because the standard to file charges to prosecute an officer is so high that they walk away with no charges. And so the overall point is accountability, whether it's qualified immunity, whether it's how you prosecute, whether it's having a registry where officers who are bad can't just bounce from department to department. You know, we've seen several egregious cases recently, and we've seen that the officers have either resigned or they fired. But I think what most people don't realize is all they have to do is just go down the road to another town and be right back on a police force, you know, having no accountability for whatever bad actions they took in their last job.
So do I hear you saying there may be another way to hold officers accountable that could be a workaround when it comes to qualified immunity?
Well, right now what is on the table is qualified immunity. If my colleagues, whether it's Senator Scott or someone else, can show how we can keep an officer accountable, then I'm open to hear it. I haven't heard it so far.
Is that what they're working on?
So right now it's qualified immunity. It might be. There absolutely have been discussions, and maybe in our next meeting I will hear some other alternatives, but I just can't emphasize enough. Right now, qualified immunity is what is on the table.
And you said at the beginning the Floyd family is asking, is saying that what comes from these negotiations is more important than the speed. Do I understand you to say this could drag on for some time?
Well, I think that, well, we obviously did not meet the deadline today. I don't believe it's going to drag on for months. I do think we need more time. I don't think it makes sense to set a deadline right now because I would just be making one up. But I can tell you that we have made significant progress, and I am hoping that we will be able to get this job done shortly.
But is it your sense, I mean, just to go back to this question about holding officers accountable, that there may be give on the part of Republicans on that?
Well, I mean, I think all of us come to the negotiating table with an open mind. We have to. Otherwise, there's no point in negotiating. You can just submit your opinions and then walk away. And so I think on both sides, there's an open mind and there's a willingness to say, okay, if not this, then that. But show me. So right now, Section 242, lowering the standard to prosecute an officer, also qualified immunity are still on the table. But, you know, there's many, many, many other aspects of the bill that we are also talking about. Having national standards, national accreditation, banning no-knock, banning chokeholds, having a registry for bad officers, providing grants to communities so that they can re-envision public safety. What does it need? What does a community need to be safe?
In the last analysis at this point, Congresswoman, do you think there will be a bill that passes the Senate?
Oh, I do think there will be a bill that passes the Senate. I believe that President Biden will have a bill to sign.
All right, we will leave it there, and we'll continue to follow it very closely. Thank you so much, Congresswoman Karen Bass.
All right, thank you.
And let's focus more on what's happening in Minneapolis 1 year later. Next November, city voters will be asked to approve a measure that could dismantle the police department and fold it into a broader Department of Public Safety. Minneapolis police have been mired in controversy for decades and soon will be the subject of a federal Department of Justice investigation. But the campaign to bring change is fraught with complications. Special correspondent Fred DeSam-Lazaro has our report, part of our series, Race Matters.
Derek Chauvin's conviction for the murder of George Floyd brought celebration and relief in Minneapolis after nearly a year of anguish, protests, destruction. It was short-lived.
A 10-year-old with a gunshot wound to the head. Why is this community not angry?
Shamonda Greer's grandson, Latavian Garrett Jr., was one of two young children critically injured in separate gunfire incidents in the city's majority black Northside neighborhood.
Because a cop didn't shoot him? Where's everybody at? We only march when it's up against the police, huh?
Greer made an impromptu appearance at a news conference called by several city leaders last week to address violent crime, which, like in most American cities, has spiked this year. It's on track to double 2020 rates. Compounding matters, the police department has seen an exodus with recent retirements, resignations, and leaves of absence. Chief Madara Arredondo pleaded for the community's help.
I am down about a third of our department. We cannot do this work alone, but we've got to come together. This violence cannot continue.
Even as some city leaders and citizens express concern about an understaffed police department just when crime is rising in Minneapolis, critics of the police department say the answer to the spike in violent crime is not necessarily to hire more officers.
I don't think that we need more cops.
Karina Smith heads Yes for Minneapolis, a black-led coalition of citizen groups campaigning to dismantle the police department. They successfully launched the petition drive to put the issue before voters in November.
This council is going to dismantle this police department.
The idea came up soon after Floyd's killing, when 9 of the city's 13 council members pledged to defund the department. Smith says the slogan simply means folding armed police officers into a larger public safety department that can respond with a wider range of skill sets.
A holistic department that includes licensed peace officers if necessary. It includes people being able to better respond to domestic violence calls. It includes people being able to better handle our homeless population, folks who are dealing with addiction.
Why black-led?
I think black-led because people at the forefront and most impacted should be leading the change.
The MPD has long had a fraught relationship with the city's black residents, about 20% of the population, and now including at least 100,000 African immigrants.
The traffic stops in Minneapolis, you know, tend to affect disproportionately black and East African drivers.
Former public radio journalist Mukhtar Ibrahim founded a news startup called Sahan Journal, focusing on issues in the growing immigrant communities. It published this video last December in an article about a traffic stop in 2015 involving 4 Somali youths.
Plain and simple, if you f*** with me, I'm going to break your leg before you can get a chance to run. Be honest, I don't screw around.
Can you tell me why I'm getting arrested?
I feel like arresting you.
Months after one of the 4 youths in the car filed an official complaint, the officer, Roderick Weber, was fired, ostensibly for these comments. But when freelance journalist Tony Webster, working for Sahan Journal, sued to get the full record, it turns out there was a lot more in that exchange, captured on audio from cameras of backup officers who were called to the scene.
Hey, you know what? You remember what happened at Black Hawk Down when we killed a bunch of your folks? I'm proud of that.
Referring to the 1993 U.S. intervention in Somalia, made famous by the movie Black Hawk Down, Weber added, quote, "If we'd finished the job, you guys wouldn't be here right now," unquote.
I think that story really displayed one part of the Minneapolis Police Department culture in terms of how it interacts with, you know, communities, especially, you know, immigrants.
The officers who were present didn't say anything about it, acted as if there was nothing that happened. That's not unusual.
Historian Bill Green says the Weber case is just one example of a pervasive culture of tolerance for racist and violent conduct. Of the nearly 2,600 complaints of police misconduct since 2013, 77 resulted in discipline, mostly suspensions or letters of reprimand. A Minneapolis Star Tribune report last year found also that in the past two decades, 8 terminations were reversed in arbitration, which is required by union contract and protected by state law. None of that will change with the city's ballot initiative.
The power of the police federation, for example, really comes from the state for all intents and purposes. The real place where we need to see systemic change is outside the hands of Minneapolis city governance.
And that's not likely to change in Minnesota's legislature, where rural Democrats and especially Republicans express strong support for the police. Republican Senate Majority Leader Paul Gazelka says an honorable profession has been maligned for the misdeeds of a few.
They are demoralized because there's this big blanket view by too many people that is harmful. We need the police to keep our streets safe.
Yes for Minneapolis campaigner Smith admits the ballot measure won't preempt state law, but she says it would allow the city to reduce the minimum police staffing now required by the city's charter. In time, she says, Minneapolis can reduce its dependence solely on police for public safety.
This first step for folks to be able to say, this is what we want, this is a direction that we need Minneapolis to head in, I think that that's part of it.
Historian Green says it's a tough sell, even in a city known for its liberal politics.
You have to respond to the person who owns a shop on the street corner, who's worried about crime. Whether crime is going to crop up because people feel like now that we're not going to be held accountable because there are no cops around, no police around to deal with it.
We are doubling down on safety beyond policing.
For his part, Mayor Jacob Frey, also up for re-election, opposes the charter amendment. He and Chief Arredondo have promised their own reforms, increased violence prevention efforts, better field training for graduates of the police academy, and no more traffic stops just for low-level violations like broken taillights or expired license tabs that disproportionately affect minority drivers. And punctuating the campaign will likely be crime news that grabs the headlines.
It's 2 kids now. What, is going to be a third one this weekend? This is 2 kids now. When are y'all going to step up?
Tragically, a third child was shot even before last weekend arrived. Unlike LaDavian and 9-year-old Trinity Otteson Smith still battling for their lives, Anaya Allen succumbed to her injuries. She was 6. For the PBS NewsHour, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Minneapolis.
Fred's report is in partnership with the Undertold Stories Project at University of St. Thomas in Minnesota. Please join us tonight at 10 p.m. Eastern on your local PBS station or online for our primetime special, America After George Floyd. In the day's other news, Moderna announced its COVID-19 vaccine strongly protects children as young as 12. The drug maker plans to ask the FDA for emergency authorization. The agency already approved Pfizer's vaccine for teens. And in an important milestone, half of all U.S. adults are now fully vaccinated. Still, the CDC urged caution today during the coming holiday.
If you are unvaccinated in the context of Memorial Day weekend, we are really encouraging you to adhere to our guidance for people who are unvaccinated and, of course, to get vaccinated.
Also today, White House COVID advisor Andy Slavitt demanded that China and the World Health Organization give definitive answers on the virus origin. There have been renewed reports that it might have been accidentally released by someone working at a Chinese lab. Airlines began avoiding Belarus today after a plane was forced down there on Sunday and a dissident journalist was arrested. Animation from a Swedish firm showed airliners diverting around Belarusian airspace. European officials had urged the move. Belarus's president, Alexander Lukashenko, has been cracking down on leaders of last year's mass protests. The White House says President Biden and Russia's President Vladimir Putin will hold a summit next month in Geneva. It's to be their first face-to-face encounter since Mr. Biden took office, and it will come at the end of his first international trip. The Biden administration issued an international call today to rebuild the Palestinian territory, Gaza, without helping the militant organization Hamas. The latest war between Hamas and Israel ended Friday in a ceasefire. In Jerusalem today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken met with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and said helping Gaza now could stave off yet another war.
We know that to prevent a return to violence, we have to use the space created to address a larger set of underlying issues and challenges. And that begins with tackling the grave humanitarian situation in Gaza and starting to rebuild.
Blinken did not meet with Hamas, which the U.S. regards as a terrorist group. He did announce that the U.S. consulate in Jerusalem will reopen to help manage relations with the Palestinians. Back in this country, a federal judge in New York dismissed an indictment against Steve Bannon, a former advisor to former President Trump. He was accused of defrauding investors in a southern border wall project. The judge cited President Trump's pardon of Bannon back in January, just before leaving office. Republican leaders in the U.S. House of Representatives denounced Marjorie Taylor Greene today for saying face mask mandates are like the Nazis' treatment of Jews. House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy called it appalling, but he did not demand disciplinary action against the congresswoman. It is the latest in a series of blow-ups involving the Georgia representative. A congressional hearing today put a spotlight on the growing drought emergency in the western U.S. Nearly all of Arizona, California, Nevada, and Utah are now in extreme drought conditions. A U.S. Interior Department official told the hearing that the drought is on an epic scale.
In California, we're approaching the driest year since we started recording in 1896. Water years 2020 and 2021 are the second driest two-year period on record. In the Colorado River Basin, we're undergoing the driest 21-year period in over 100 years of record-keeping and one of the longest drought cycles in the past 1,200 years.
Scientists blame the drought on climate change caused by humans as well as other factors. And on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 81 points to close at 34,312. The Nasdaq fell 4 points. The S&P 500 slipped 9. Still to come on the NewsHour, why the Justice Department does not want to release a secret memo on charging former President Trump. Taiwan's foreign minister discusses the ever larger shadow China casts over the region. And COVID-19 exacerbates the many societal inequities across Brazil.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Late last night, the Justice Department released a heavily redacted document that played an important role in the decision not to charge former President Trump with obstruction of justice. Our John Yang explores.
Judy, the 9-page memo was sent to then-Attorney General William Barr by the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. That's the office that gives legal advice to government agencies. Barr said it was the basis for his conclusion that there was not enough evidence to establish that President Trump broke obstruction of justice laws. A watchdog group sued to make it public, and earlier this month, a judge said it must be released. Well, last night, the Justice Department released a heavily redacted version of it and said it would continue to fight in court to keep the rest of it secret. Noah Bookbinder is president and CEO of Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, also known as CREW. CREW is the group that sued for the memo's release. Mr. Bookbinder, thanks so much for joining us. Your group filed this suit literally the afternoon of Attorney General Barr's news conference. What does this struggle over this document, whether to keep it secret or not, what does this represent to you, sort of the larger implications of this struggle?
Absolutely. Well, what it looked like happened back when the Mueller report came out was that the Attorney General and the people at the Justice Department reporting to him, this was Bill Barr, set out not to do a real legal analysis of whether Donald Trump had obstructed justice, but rather to publicly defend Donald Trump and to make the case for why he hadn't done anything wrong. And that's why we wanted to see this memo that he said he relied on to make this announcement that there was no basis to say that Donald Trump had obstructed justice. And the Justice Department has fought for years to keep it from going public, I think in large part because it does show that there was a whitewashing to protect the then president.
What did we learn? We got a page and a half essentially last night. What did we learn in that page and a half?
Well, what we did learn is, and we really got two things. We got that page and a half, and then we got the full unredacted version of a federal judge's opinion talking about this document and about this case. And from those two things, we did learn that the Justice Department lawyers essentially said that what they were thinking about was not so much the legal analysis, but the case that could be made to the public. And so it really was starting to kind of blow the lid off of this and show that what we all thought was happening really was what was happening.
And Judge Amy Berman Jackson's ruling does have some pretty strong language about the Justice Department. They said that she wrote that she looked at the unredacted memo and she wrote that DOJ, the Justice Department, has been disingenuous to this court with respect to the existence of a decision-making process that should be shielded by deliberative process privilege. In other words, she's saying here that that this is not a decision-making process because the decision's already been made.
That's right. I mean, well, the way that she laid it out is the Justice Department was clear that they weren't going to prosecute Donald Trump. They believed their rules set out that you couldn't prosecute a sitting president. So essentially, this was sort of a PR document. This was, you know, what should we say to the public? And for the Justice Department to come and say this was some kind of a deliberative, pre-decisional document is not really honest because there wasn't a legal decision being made. And you know, we really had hoped that having gotten this just absolutely scathing decision from Judge Jackson, that the Justice Department would look at this and say, now is the time to really go for a clean slate and sort of admit that the department under Bill Barr had been dishonest, behaved badly, and now it's time to come clean, produce the document, and clean up the department and show that it's not going to be used for the protection of any president. And it's disappointing that instead they've chosen to continue fighting this case.
Noah Bookbinder, the Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me.
Taiwan is the issue creating the most tension right now between Beijing and the U.S. China considers Taiwan a breakaway province. Taiwan argues that it serves as the front line of democracy against Chinese authoritarianism and is increasingly facing military harassment. Nick Schifrin speaks to Taiwan's foreign minister and sets the scene.
In Taiwan, authorities fear drills are becoming reality. Taiwanese pilots scramble American-made fighter jets to practice responding to Chinese military incursions. Taiwanese soldiers practice defending their island from would-be Chinese invasion. Taiwan believes Beijing is preparing for war. The Chinese military recently released this video of Chinese drills simulating amphibious assaults. And almost every day, Chinese jets cross Taiwan's self-identified airspace defense identification zone. Never before have so many Chinese planes come so close to Taiwan. Senior Biden administration officials tell PBS NewsHour they do not expect an imminent invasion. But in March, the outgoing top U.S. military commander in the region predicted war was coming.
I think the threat is manifest during this decade, in fact, in the next 6 years.
The Trump administration increased arms sales to Taiwan. The Biden administration continued expanded U.S. naval operations and became the first administration to invite Taiwan's envoy to inauguration. I spoke to Taiwan's foreign minister, Joseph Wu, from Taipei, and asked him what he believed were Beijing's intentions.
I think Beijing has been preparing for a war against Taiwan, and that is what we have been seeing. They are preparing for it. If you look at the number of sorties, it's around 2,900 times last year. So the threat has been increasing. And when we examine closer way, the Chinese sometimes even cross the middle line of the Taiwan Strait. And, you know, the middle line of the Taiwan Strait has been safeguarding peace and stability of the Taiwan Strait for decades. I think they are also trying to cut off Taiwan from the international society. For example, they're trying to squeeze us out from the international organizations. They prevent us from entering into the World Health Organization. They're preventing us from getting international recognition. They are forcing other countries not to have official contact with us. And moreover, Chinese are also engaging in a cognitive warfare. They use cyber attack, disinformation, and something similar to disrupt the democratic process here in Taiwan to create a conflict in between the government and the society, or to create a distrust in between Taiwan and our major ally, which is the United States.
Focusing on the military threat for a minute, if you believe that Beijing is preparing for war and getting better, presumably, at pointing at Taiwan by conducting these missions, these exercises, in some ways, is Taiwan getting better at defending itself, at doing the things it would need to do if those exercises actually become the real thing?
Yes, we are getting better. But at the same time, we also understand the kinds of gap of defense capabilities that we have with China. And therefore, we are assessing the kinds of situation that we need to be in and trying to prepare ourselves for it. We understand our own responsibility as a frontline state guarding against the expansion of authoritarianism.
The U.S. is increasing its arms sales to Taiwan, but it is restricted by agreements decades old of what it can sell to Taiwan. Do you believe the U.S. is giving you enough to defend yourselves?
If you look at the track record of the last few years, last 2 or 3 years, we have been able to get what we need for Taiwan to be able to defend itself.
Are you satisfied with the commitment that the U.S. has made to defend Taiwan, or do you prefer a less ambiguous commitment and a more specific commitment to defend Taiwan if attacked from Beijing?
The full picture is that we are seeing the United States getting more and more serious about the situation in this part of the world. You know, beginning from last year, the United States has been patrolling or, you know, going through the Taiwan Strait with its naval vessels at least once a month. And that is a very strong determination of the United States to show its presence. And the United States is not only sending fleets to the region, the United States is also sending military aircrafts into the region. And I think the level of engagement between Taiwan and the United States on military terms or defensive issues has been increasing to a level that we haven't seen before. We need the U.S. support, and the U.S. has shown its support to Taiwan. And I think this is much better than getting into the debate of strategic ambiguity or strategic clarity.
Is it possible, do you think, that instead of preparing for war, some China experts here tell us that instead Beijing simply wants to deter independence, that they are actually sending a political message more than a military one?
That might be possible, that they have that kind of thinking. But if you look at the situation here in Taiwan, you know, we are by ourselves. We are not administered by China. We just had, repeated and periodical national elections, and we have been said by the international society as a success story of democracy. So Taiwan is by itself, and therefore pointing to Taiwan that Taiwan is seeking independence, it's just like, you know, creating a scapegoat and or finding an excuse to attack Taiwan. But we are really concerned if China is seeing some domestic difficulties, they might follow the classic wisdom of an authoritarian regime. They will find a scapegoat somewhere outside to divert the domestic attention. And we are very concerned that Taiwan may be that very convenient scapegoat for China's own failure domestically.
The Biden administration has released new guidelines on meetings between American and Taiwanese officials. The administration says it has eased previous restrictions. Have restrictions actually been eased?
Yes, indeed. The restrictions have been eased, and we are seeing the kinds of contacts that we haven't seen before. And it's not only the ease of the contact restrictions. The Biden administration has also been sending all kinds of goodwill gestures to Taiwan, like reassuring Taiwan that the relations have been rock solid, providing Taiwan with necessary oral support, and also lining up the like-minded countries like Japan, Australia, and G7 countries, and now Korea, to address the concern about the peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. So all these are being appreciated.
What do you say to critics of that announced change, that it goes against some of those decades of agreements that the U.S. has had with Beijing, and by coming closer to Taiwan, by having those meetings, it could actually increase the chances of the war with Beijing that we were talking about at the beginning?
There have been some senior official contacts in between the two sides, except that we kept it very quiet. And as far as we see it, the Chinese are not increasing its military operations around Taiwan because of that kind of ease of the contact guidelines. On the other hand, we see the Chinese seem to be preparing for war against Taiwan based on its own merit. Whenever it feels the need, they will send its bombers to fly close to Taiwan to scare the Taiwanese people. And when we are in a weak point, like the pandemic we are in, the Chinese would suddenly increase its disinformation campaign against Taiwan.
Foreign Minister Joseph Wu, thank you very much.
Thank you, Nick. I hope I have a chance to welcome you in Taiwan in person.
All across the cities of Brazil, slums, known as favelas, have long been places of crime and poverty, marked by overcrowding and unsanitary conditions. They are among the hardest hit by the pandemic, in a country where the death toll just passed 450,000. In the second of two reports, NewsHour's special correspondent Simon Ostrovsky and producer Charles Lyons report on Brazil's COVID crisis.
I couldn't speak. I couldn't breathe. The whole time, thinking I was going to die, suffocated.
Camila de Oliveira Souza is a hairdresser who lives in Villa Kennedy, a favela about an hour's drive from the famous beaches of Rio de Janeiro. Late last year, she woke up one morning without any sense of taste. Things got worse, quickly. She was taken to a local hospital where there were no beds, and she was forced to sleep in an armchair. Several days later, a doctor told her if she stayed any longer, she'd likely die. She returns home, where she isolated in her cramped apartment.
Many people turned their back on us. But many people also reached out.
As with any epidemic or pandemic, what we see are all inequalities are illuminated. So when you look at the number of deaths in Brazil, or the US for that matter, what we see is that the most vulnerable, the people that were more isolated, the ethnic minorities, they are the ones that really are suffering the most.
Marcia Castro is the chair of the Department of Global Health and Population at Harvard's Chan School of Public Health. She said an equitable response by the Brazilian Health Service would have led to fewer deaths. That didn't happen.
With its thousands of crowded slums and hundreds of far-flung indigenous communities that are underserved, Brazil's minorities are dying at a much higher rate than the average across the country.
Camila might just be a statistic if it weren't for nonprofits that picked up the slack from a government that ignored people like her.
How come the favelas have done so much worse than the average across Brazil?
The pandemic did not cause, but actually exposed the already existing problems in these communities.
Mario Love works with an organization called CUFA, a favela union that fights to improve the lives of people in favelas like Villa Kennedy.
One of the times that I was delivering some hygiene products, the basic materials that help prevent contamination, I went to a house that had 14 grandchildren inside of it, and that's not even taking into account the rest of the family. This is the reality that shows how the virus can be spread not only inside a house, but in the streets as well.
But overcrowding isn't the only issue Brazil's slums, favelas, face.
The population living in the slum, it does not have access to sanitation. When the pandemic crisis that we are facing started, we had, and still have, great difficulty having access to water.
Priscila França is a co-founder of the São Paulo-based National Anti-Racist Front, an NGO that fights racism against the mostly black populations in favelas there.
Most people living in favelas are black people. They are poor people, and most of them are women. They are heads of families. Speaking of inequalities, we live in a country where 97% of people living in the favela do not have access to any kind of medical insurance.
Poor sanitary conditions and overcrowding increases the likelihood of infection, and yet lack of medical insurance decreases the chance of favela residents getting proper care. Across the country, in the Amazonian state of Pará, ribeirinhos, or river people, suffer opposite problems. Their isolation is their Achilles heel, making it challenging for them to get medical help they need during a global health crisis like this one.
Brazilian society is finding out with the pandemic that if we are in a difficult situation, we could be much worse without the community associations, the indigenous movement, the favelas movement, a big movement of solidarity, doing what the government should do, but didn't.
Caetano Scanavino co-founded the NGO Saúde and Alegria, Health and Happiness, back in 1987. Its mission, to ensure food security and a wide range of support for communities along the Amazon and Tapajós rivers outside the city of Santarém. During the pandemic, the organization went into overdrive, giving food and PPE to over 50,000 people since the crisis began.
We work with traditional population communities, like indigenous people, people that are here before then the Portuguese arrive. And they are in remote areas. There is no mobile, no cell phone, no energy.
Caetano told me government health agents don't fully understand the complexities of helping the tiny river communities his NGO serves.
This is why Brazil needs far more vaccines urgently. Small medical teams like this one have to travel for hours to villages like this one, where sometimes they're only vaccinating a dozen people. Sometimes they're only vaccinating one person. With more vaccines, communities like this could become fully vaccinated and they wouldn't have to come back.
But one marginalized group that is finally getting the vaccine is Brazil's indigenous people, despite widespread misinformation campaigns earlier in the pandemic.
There were many lies spread and a lot of fake news. This ended up creating fear and mistrust among many people. Coming from the indigenous, there was a high rate of rejection to being vaccinated.
Sonia Guajajara is not only a leader in her territory in the northeastern Brazilian state of Maranhão, she's also a nationally recognized figure who in 2018 ran for vice president of Brazil on a far-left ticket that challenged eventual winner Jair Bolsonaro. Now she serves as one of the executive coordinators of a national organization dedicated to indigenous rights and health. In mid-April, when Sonia invited us to visit, she and others in her tribe had already been vaccinated. And yet months earlier, many indigenous friends and relatives had been infected and died. According to data collected by Guajajara's group, since the beginning of the pandemic, more than 54,500 indigenous people have been infected, and more than 1,080 indigenous have died, including dozens of elders. That's a massive toll for a countrywide population of roughly 800,000. It's a death rate 6 times higher than that of the rest of Brazil. While Guajajara said her people's communal way of living and immunological vulnerabilities contributed to the high rate of infection, she mostly attributes the large number of COVID deaths to President Bolsonaro's harsh views on indigenous, which he expressed even as a candidate.
In his first day of office, the first acts were to dismantle indigenous people's rights and to try to end the indigenous policy of Brazil. It's impossible to have a health system that feeds all indigenous people. We are 365 groups, over 6,000 villages all over Brazil in different regions. It should be a priority for the system to make itself suitable to the different realities.
Guajajara says Brazil's national immunization plan doesn't include the large swath of indigenous living in urban areas. She fears they won't get vaccinated quickly enough and will continue to die. She believes help should come from outside of Brazil.
It's important to have international solidarity at the moment, to help put pressure on Bolsonaro's government to be more responsible with the population, adopt responsible and effective measures in his public policies to avoid the increase of infections and deaths.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Simon Ostrovsky in Maranhão.
As we mark this moment, 1 year since a murder in Minneapolis set off a national reckoning, we hope you'll join us at 10 p.m. Eastern tonight for our NewsHour special on PBS, Race Matters, America After George Floyd.
In a year of racial reckoning, violence, abuse, and inequities persist.
We, the jury, find the defendant guilty.
The Chauvin verdict hinted at a path to justice. Yet much more is to be done.
Now's the time to act.
How can we create lasting change? Race Matters. America After George Floyd. A PBS NewsHour special report. Tuesday, May 25th at 10 p.m., 9 Central.
And you can watch that special report here on your PBS station again at 10 p.m. Eastern and join the conversation by following the NewsHour online. And a quick news update before we go. There is word that a grand jury has joined a probe of former President Trump and others at the Trump Organization. The Washington Post and others are now reporting that the Manhattan District Attorney convened the panel. He's investigating whether Trump properties were overvalued to defraud banks and insurance firms and illegally gain tax benefits. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.